Hi, I'm Karen Webster, and welcome to The Matchmaker Is In. As always, I'm joined by David Evans, co-author of the book by the same name. Hey, David, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Karen, and thanks for plugging the book.
And, of course, the book is called Matchmakers with an S, available on Amazon.com. And today we are both joined by Rob Chevelle, CEO of Avine. Hey, Rob, thanks for joining David and me today.
Hey, Rob.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rob, we're going to talk about an interesting facet of the matchmaker business, one that doesn't really have a direct relationship to igniting a matchmaker or even necessarily how they're designed, although I think you're going to debate me on that point later. But an issue that is pretty important to the regulation, whether self-regulated or regulation by other means of online matchmakers, and that's consumer privacy. One of the things that Avine does is provide consumers with an opportunity to do a bunch of things online with masking their identity, including how they choose to pay on sites that they're actually buying from. And the interesting issue that brings up is consumer interests and business interest may be at cross purposes, and so we'd like to dig into that just a little bit. But let's start at the beginning. Tell us, Avine, what you guys do and why you decided Avine was something you wanted to bring into the world.
Sure. So basically, Avine offers consumers software in the form of apps and web browser extensions. And that software enables them, no matter where they go and no matter what device they're using, to choose what information, and I'm talking about what kinds of personal information that all of us have, we choose to share with which third parties. And to make that very concrete and simple, the user experience of using Avine software, which is called Blur, is basically, you go to a website, for example, to make a payment, and you choose whether to use a credit card that we can help you autofill and check out with more quickly, or you can tokenize your card and create a brand new card just for that merchant and pay that merchant with that new card number online. And we do that for all kinds of credential information, including letting you keep your mobile phone number private and use a different number that forwards calls to your real mobile number, and we do the same thing for emails and other kinds of credentials. So the simple theme is the consumer gets to choose which kinds of personal information they're willing to share with which third parties.
And what are you finding that most consumers are reluctant to share with any merchant? And how has that changed over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so obviously there's been a big, and you spoke about regulatory trends and whirlwinds and things of that nature. And since Snowden and everything, there's been a lot of discussion, I think, across really the globe about online privacy and privacy in general, and where do we draw the lines between these different things. I think what we've seen when we look at our statistics, and, you know, we do actually measure in aggregate some of the themes and the things that our users are doing, we see a pretty interesting balance between users that want to share their information and just move quicker through the internet when they're browsing and use our software to basically autofill their credentials and in a sense, they're comfortable disclosing their credentials with most websites. And then we see a fraction of those users that will always choose to protect their personal information from every site. And so those are the two sort of extremes, the people that want to share everything and just want a speedier internet experience, whether they're shopping or logging into sites and things like that, versus the people that are that have some bias to be completely private. What I would say is that those extremes represent about 20% of our user base, which is half based in the United States and half of our users, of which we have several million, are global. So, you know, I think what we see in between those two extremes is where most of the users fall, which is they'll share some of their information with some third parties, and I'm talking about their real information, not the tokenized information that we help them generate, and yet they'll also choose at certain times to stay private with respect to certain websites or certain shopping experiences.
Mm-hmm. And is there a particular kind of information that consumers are most reluctant to share in that middle category?
Yeah, I think two things pop up when we look at the numbers. One is mobile phone numbers. Mm-hmm. I think people are frustrated by getting spam text messages and spam calls, auto dialers and so forth to their mobile device. I think it's a very personal experience for all of us. And when we lose control of our number, it's frustrating. So we see most of our users using our mass phone numbers, especially when they are just making an order from a particular vendor and they want to get the call to make sure that it arrived or that it had been shipped, but they don't really need an ongoing persistent relationship with that vendor. And then also, I'll bring up the concept of data breaches. We do see a very strong correlation between online merchants that have recent data breaches and our users choosing to use these new virtual credit cards, which we call mass cards, that we provide to our users instead of putting their actual Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover on file with those vendors that have had a recent security breach and lost financial information.
So the value proposition, I was going to ask you about the value proposition to the merchant who doesn't now have a relationship with that customer because they don't actually know who it is, but in the case that you just described, at least they're still getting the sale. But what is the merchant reaction to this and the anonymity of the customer? Do they just care about the incremental sale, or do they feel as though they're losing something because they're not really able to remarket to that particular person?
And if I could just add to that, is it the merchant who's losing something, or is it the data brokers that they might be dealing with that are losing something?
That's a great question, David. And Karen, I will push back on this concept that people protecting their privacy have to also be anti-merchant or anti-marketing. I think there's a balance, and I think actually, David, you know, you may be familiar as an author with Seth Godin and this concept of opt-in marketing. I think what, in a way, our software enables is for consumers to reverse the traditional marketing relationship that merchants have had with them and allow merchants to market to them, but on their terms, more so on their terms. So what do I mean by that? Let me give you an example. We protect users' email addresses often with merchants. So the merchant won't get a quote-unquote my Gmail address, for example, but they'll get a unique email address. Now, that address isn't a fake one. It's not one that I've made up, and the merchant indeed can market to it. And indeed, we run a very large set of servers at Amazon Web Services that specialize in forwarding along those emails, keeping them private, but allowing that marketing, that direct marketing, to occur. And we're now at a rate where we're enabling 50 million or so of those emails a month to move from merchants and other third parties to our consumer user base. And only about 5% of our users choose to block those marketing emails. So I think that's very indicative that there is a balance and that there is receptivity from individuals that may want to protect some degree of their privacy or gain some amount of control in a marketing relationship, but yet are still quite receptive to getting traditional emails and other forms of marketing from merchants. So I think there's a win-win there.
But if they're opting in, why aren't they opting in using their real email?
Well, let's think about it. If I'm a user and I give you, if I give a merchant or frankly anybody my real email, then I don't really have an option to opt out. In a way, you can say that I do because I have an unsubscribe link and some kind of regulation that says I must have one if I'm part of the Direct Marketing Association to talk about self-regulation. But what happens is that companies abuse, and I'm not calling out any particular merchants, but we can actually see companies and third parties, and this goes back to David's comment about data brokers and middlemen. They abuse these kinds of personal information and this kind of data because there's profit to be made in doing so. So all of a sudden, after I've given my email out to one reputable company, that email can get moved into lists, sold, repurchased, and all of a sudden I'm getting all kinds of spam and other things I didn't want. So the idea of giving a unique email address to a third party is that the user retains a much higher degree of control in how that email address is used. And if it's used appropriately, as I said, 95% of our users see value in receiving emails to their inboxes. And the last point I'd make is we work very hard to get those emails to the user's actual inboxes. This is not analogous to sort of that junk mail, throwaway account that some of us have created to give away simply for spam purposes. No. We actually forward these emails to, in most cases, the user's primary email address. We just keep that actual email address private.
Interesting. Do you feed back information to the merchants about the types of outreach that consumers are most interested in getting? How do you close the loop, if at all, with the merchants that consumers are interacting with?
Yeah, we really haven't, and I'd say shame on us a little bit, we haven't done enough work to enable good APIs for our merchants that would be interested in getting feedback from the user base and sort of optimizing some of the channels of communication to the users. I think, frankly, we need to grow our user base a bit more before some of the top-tier merchants would be interested in working with us. But I think the future, does lie in a lot of merchants being able to better understand at least the demographic of people around the world that are going to increasingly want control over their personal information and only want to buy and work with merchants that value that and that understand that. And I think, brand plays a big part in that. And, enabling platforms like ours should be helpful in that conversation.
We're seeing intensification, teams, of the battle between consumers and advertisers as consumers get increasingly reluctant to or dissatisfied with the kind of advertising they're getting. Are you seeing that play out, and are you seeing increased concern by consumers in how they're seeing and having advertising delivered to them, either on their desktops or mobile devices?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think, honestly, I think our company, Abine, is maybe one step in the future from the debate that has the most consumers active in it right now, which is about
you guys aren't you're not an ad blocker. You're just a intermediary that makes life easier for the consumer.
That's right. And what I was about to touch on is that ad blocking has become sort of the first battleground. I think we play a more sophisticated role in being a broker and enabler of a new way to exchange identity and credential information online. But if we want to just talk about ad blockers, that's where most of the discussion is being had, because we now have over a quarter billion, 250 million people actively using ad blockers. And, that is enough of a footprint to cause significant debate, at least in the ad tech realm. And, I think it's from a personal standpoint, I think it's very hard on mobile devices right now to even go to some media properties. You get about half of your screen real estate. You're clicking on things all the time. It is a broken model. And I think the way that the industry tries to solve that problem and meet consumer needs is a reflection of the same kind of debates and infrastructure that companies like us need to build to connect merchants and consumers together in a more healthy way.
So you are a matchmaker.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to debate whether we are or we aren't, Karen. But I would point out, and I'm thinking about David's book right now, I would point out that a lot of the platforms, take Airbnb as an example, where you have these marketplaces between consumers and providers, they play actually, in many ways, they play a similar function in protecting identity information, but also verifying identity information that Abine does. And what do I mean by that? I mean, if I'm, if I'm on Airbnb, they actually enable me to receive phone calls and to potentially contact the different, people that I may rent a place from without divulging all of their identity information. But at the same time, I'm ensured that I have some level of trust, that they've been vetted, and so forth. So I think when we're doing in some ways at the level of the entire web what some of these marketplaces and matchmakers are enabling between consumers and service providers. And I think they provide a very important function. And I think it is not just about it's about a mix of privacy and trust and assertion of identity and credentials. And all of those things have to work together to make the solution right. The solution is not to just give away all the consumer's actual information and make it instantly available to everybody. That doesn't work because of data breaches. It doesn't work because of security issues. It doesn't work for a lot of reasons. So tokenization, these kinds of technologies that you're seeing come up in every day in the payments world are going to be important across all of the consumer's credentials. You're going to see them move from matchmaker marketplaces, the kinds of things that David looks at all the time, into a more broad web-wide omni-channel context, which is what Abine is trying to enable.
So, Rob, you touched on, and you just touched on it a little bit now, you said we're several steps into the future beyond ad blockers. I mean, basically, you're giving consumers the tools to decide how and when they want to be contacted and by whom. So the implications now for the businesses are what should they be taking away from this capability that now you're arming consumers to be able to use?
Well, I think if we can draw some lessons from the ad block marketplace and the current debate, and I was part of the W3C's standards body efforts around the Do Not Track standard, which preceded some of the growth in ad blockers, where the industry was trying to figure out a framework for self-regulating online advertising, and they never succeeded in getting to a standard for Do Not Track. And I think and as soon as that failed, the growth of ad blockers exploded. And so I think it's a cautionary tale in some respects that, you know, while merchants may be after every last dollar and every last piece of data, they should, you know, they're ultimately going to need to be smarter and more nuanced about what their relationship with consumers is. And if they do that, they'll get less than, you know, 90% of their visitors clicking on guest checkout, and many more of them registering and having an opt-in, sustainable, persistent, you know, account-based relationship with merchants. So I think there's, again, I think the lessons are there are opportunities for consumers and businesses to work together online in ways that they haven't done so before. And if they don't do that, what we're going to see is, you know, is a lot of growth of sort of black and white kinds of things like ad blockers, which actually can hurt, you know, businesses in ways that take a long time to recover from.
It seems to me that in a lot of cases, you're actually doing the merchant a service, because even though they may not get some information that in an ideal world they would like, you're giving some assurance to the consumer and therefore getting them to buy from the merchant as opposed to clicking on to something, some other site where they might have a higher degree of trust.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll give you a specific example. Our Mass Card service, which again is the thing where we go create, say, a new 16-digit card number for you right on the fly when you're shopping at a particular site. Sometimes merchants will reject those cards. Merchants have technologies to look at the bin and see whether the number is a prepaid number and it falls into certain categories and so forth. So every once in a while, we'll get that. A merchant will actually reject one of our masked virtual cards for no good reason. And obviously, the payments world is complex, and there's a lot of reasons why they have those technologies, but it's crazy to us because that is actually guaranteed funds. We at Abine are guaranteeing that merchant that card is valid and it has that money on it. So they can't get a better lower fraud transaction than one that we provide with a Mass card. So call me crazy, but yes, I think there's all kinds of ways from the credit card all the way through to email and phone where trust and validity and assertions can ride sort of alongside greater privacy controls for the consumer and benefit the merchant.
Do mobile wallets solve the problem, or could they?
Well, if you look at what PayPal's done, and you know, it'd be an interesting conversation to have it at some future session. They disclose some, but not all, of the user's credentials to merchants when they hit the PayPal button, and I think mobile wallets are very analogous. If you look at Visa Checkout and MasterPass, they're following in that same structural pattern. So I think the it at least enables the conversation to happen when you have your credentials stored with a trusted partner. It enables the partner to broker for your identity on your behalf. And then the question becomes, who do you trust? Do you trust MasterCard because they're a great big company and a great brand, but they have to work with lots of merchants and they may have merchants' interests at their core? Or do you trust a company like Abine who doesn't have anywhere near that brand recognition, but that it has a mission 100% focused on empowering consumer control?
Interesting. We're about out of our time, but we always love to get the perspective of those we talk to about matchmakers that, in the truest sense of the word, they kind of admire and think have gotten kind of the matchmaker fundamental principles correct. I mean, thinking about your lens around which you look at things too, which is providing the consumer with the opportunity to have the choice and the opportunity to engage as they might wish to do so on those platforms. Anyone come to mind?
Well, I'll be contrarian, and as I love to be, and I'll bring up Craigslist because they're so old that I don't think anybody gives them any credit anymore. But I would say the following about Craigslist, which was really one of the first marketplaces, right, that set the standard for a lot of this stuff, and I think, in a large way, although you can accuse them of trying to sue everybody that tried to take some of their liquidity out of existence, in a large way they've held very true to the principles that made the Craigslist marketplace work in the first place, and they haven't muddied it up. And that has its benefits and it has its drawbacks. But I'll tell you that I admire very much the consistency that they've displayed in keeping a model that was simple enough to work across a broad set of vertical markets intact and quite liquid. And the other one I'd mention, because I love it so much, is Amazon Turk, where you can get incredible parallel work distribution through a growing network of freelancers all over the world.
Yeah,
that's really interesting, Karen, because I think those are highly original and interesting suggestions. There's a tendency for everyone to say Uber, but I think the point that Craigslist was an early and very successful matchmaker and continues to be, I think that's a great point.
Yeah, it's a very good, and the Amazon Turks. I mean, that was that was one of the original sort of crowdsourced on-demand labor forces that I think a lot of people forget about. But you're right, very, very powerful.
It's like the cash of the online world, Karen, in the sense that it's all very simple and seems a bit outdated, but it works really well.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Well, listen, Rob, it was great to have the conversation. It was a great conversation, actually, about a very, very important topic and one that will, I think, drive a lot of design of how matchmakers will, in fact, need to think about their platforms going forward and how they choose to provide the consumer with the choice to let themselves be known the way they feel like they need to let themselves be made available and their data shared appropriately. Thanks. It was great. David, any final thoughts from you?
No more final thoughts.
Rob, thanks very much for your time, and thanks everyone who joined us today. I hope everyone has a great rest of the day, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.